You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Good morning. What's the weather like today? Is it a good day for a walk? That's our topic for the day. But before getting stuck into it, I'd like to acknowledge that I, and probably most of you, live, work and play on Kaurna lands. We acknowledge the Kaurna people as the traditional owners and honour their ancestors and their current elders. It's always a pleasure to see them welcoming us and visitors when we have festivals and conventions in Adelaide. I'm going to start this talk far away from Kaurna lands, in Yorkshire, with a piece of social history that surprised, and on reflection did not surprise me, about how different social classes regarded walking. I will read you an excerpt from Fiona Shaw's Tell It to the Bees, set in the early 1950s in Yorkshire. So for you, a little virtual time travel, as well as virtual tourism, neither of which you can engineer in the actual world right now. Chapter 19. Lydia felt clumsy. The socks were itchy and the boots heavier than anything she'd ever worn. Her feet caught every root, every knuckle of stone on the path. She couldn't swing her elbows like Jean did, and though it was Jean who had the heavy haversack, it was Lydia who had to call a short halt at the top of the first hill. She bent forward, hands on her thighs, while her heart slowed. "You should have brought someone used to this," she said when she caught her breath. "Making bits of wirelesses doesn't help much." Jean looked across the moorland, the brown-coloured inn here and there with purple heather, slender sheep trails dipping away into invisibility, the pale sky and curtain of shadow on the hill waiting for the sun to lift higher. She listened to the sound of small birds at work. "You'll soon find your walking legs. Eat this," she said, handing Lydia a piece of oatcake, "and the shoes will ease up." "You sound like someone's mother," Lydia said, but Jean didn't reply, and they walked on in silence. The landscape was vast and endless. It unnerved Lydia. No hedges or railings or trees, no other people, no animals, none that she could see, anyway. She had never been on a walk like this before and was unsure of herself. She wondered whether there was something more she ought to be doing. The sun drew higher in the sky. They walked steadily and Lydia discovered that Jean was right. Her heart and lungs had found their own rhythm. Walking like this, not for any other reason than to walk, and in easy silence, Lydia's thoughts roamed. She wondered where Robert would be today and what he might be doing and whether he'd be having lunch at Pam's tomorrow as usual. "Bastard," she said to herself, and then, "Oh, cow," and then laughed under her breath. "At least you don't have to do that anymore." Lydia and her son Charlie had recently been deserted by Robert, a road worker who had been brought up by his sister Pam and never cut the apron strings. By contrast, Jean's credentials were impeccably middle class. She was a doctor. Lydia continued to reflect. Robert gone. Straight words, hard ones. But walking here, high and light, she felt her mind begin to lift away from loss, to stretch itself and open up with possibilities. Daydreams they were, she knew that, but they were the first she had had in a long time. When conversation resumed, Lydia recalled her childhood. "My dad used to go off hiking, but he wouldn't take me. It was fine, women walking to work, but they weren't to do it for recreation. Then it was only for boys." "Did he tell you that?" I think he simply didn't want me along. He always dressed his dislikes into morals. I've never done this before, just walked. Jane looked at Lydia, and Lydia had the feeling she'd shocked her with this. Not even when you were little, Jane said. Not even with your uncle. Well, of course we walked, but it was always to school or the shops or the park for something. You don't wear special shoes for that. Jane laughed. But are you regretting it, she said, wishing you were home with a book? Well, it's good for letting your thoughts run, Lydia said, daydreaming. I haven't done that in a long while. When I read that, I recalled my own middle-class background. We lived frugally. Dad's principal's pay was dreadful until the last part of his career. We had no music lessons, no team sports for clubs with fees, sweets once a week. Recreation was walks with packed lunch, bottles of Bickford's lime or Cotty's raspberry cordial, tea in the thermos, fruit and sangers. You didn't stop off at delis or shops. Money was saved for holidays. I didn't twig that that was not standard until much later in life. And when I organised bushwalks for school kids, I found that here in Australia there was a subset of children in every class that whinged about going uphill, cried when they fell over, wanted to go home until soothed and cosseted and fixed up with a buddy. Primary school children, fortunately, are rather kind. These children were often Greek or Italian with parents who worked their butts off in market gardens, shops or factories. Of course, it's not just working-class people who don't have a family culture of walking. I'm sure you can think of people who will always drive, will use a golf buggy on a golf course. But it does perhaps behove us to reflect that exercise for the sake of it, it's a stronger need for people with sedentary lifestyles than to those whose working day includes a lot of walking or other physical effort. Bushwalking is a favourite pastime of some of our local Unitarians, and Jane very kindly lent me an old script of Expanding Horizons, in which the late Jacqueline Stewart interviews Jane and Clive Brooks about their experiences and thoughts about the pastime. Jacqueline migrated to South Australia from Oregon, bringing children with her. She taught in high schools, joined our church, was a member of the Expanding Horizon teams for the best part of a decade, and was one of the most elegant, witty people I've ever met, and the most exacting person to make radio programs with. No waffle, no shortcuts, and pertinent questions. Reading it made me question my habits. Bushwalking is traditionally a group activity, but I have done most walking in my life alone, because I like to let my thoughts run without interruption, except maybe in Echidna or a bandicoot. As I approach 70, I should maybe reassess the habit of solitary walking for safety reasons. I recall in my old caving days the rule of four always applied. No group less than four was permitted by CAVEX to descend into the depths, and here is why. If someone is injured, one person remains with the injured and two go for help. It lessens the risk of getting confused or lost finding the exit. Jacqueline liked to walk in a group. She appreciated the company, but also appreciated some limits in conversation. Too much, she said, interfered with her appreciation of the experience, and she quoted an excerpt from Walt Whitman's Song of the Rolling Earth. The earth does not argue, is not pathetic, has no arrangements, does not scream, haste, persuade, threaten, promise, makes no discriminations, has no conceivable failures, closes nothing, refuses nothing, shuts none out. Of all the powers, objects, states it notifies, shuts none out. Everyday reality is what shut ambition out for Lydia in the novel. The husband paid no maintenance. She had to work extra shifts, and on women's pay, then this was still insufficient to cover her living expenses. She was able on the walk to wrest thoughts away from resentment and anxiety and dream of a better life with her son elsewhere, even in another country. The other character, Jean, would have appreciated the Roman phrase solvitur ambulando, meaning solved by walking, as she used walks to mull over surgical procedures and tricky diagnoses. Generally, when I stroll, when I'm writing a letter or maybe an address like this one, I find a walk the best remedy for inertia. Because your thoughts can run and the only distractions are from nature. Who can resist a koala, a kangaroo, a blue tongue, a blue wren? They can only lighten the heart. Now, less admirable is Noel Coward's quip, "I like long walks, especially when they're taken by people I dislike." Now, that is worthy of Ogden Nash, I think, of Parsley's ghastly fame. But let's return to words from people in our own community. Clive Brooks was introduced to bushwalking as a school boarder in the 1950s. He recalls the headmaster who took them on walks, not so much for building character or providing physical exercise, but because he liked to treat the lads as family, bearing in mind they saw their parents only every fourth weekend. And it contributed in a broad sense to their education. They had to work out what to carry, what to wear, clothing, water, and so on. So a bit of self-reliance as well as the geography of the regions near Adelaide. By contrast, Jane came to it much later in life. She and Clive had twins. Their busy life and time constraints relegated bushwalking to a holiday activity, together with boating, fishing, hunting, and swimming. In term time, the botanic gardens and the zoo were more regular opportunities to walk. One of our former ministers, Mark Alstrom, was inspired by our pioneer minister, Francis Duffield, who is believed to have given Sunday services at Shady Grove and then walked about 30 kilometres to Adelaide to give another in the evening. I would love to know if anyone can verify this story. Anyway, Mark took it seriously and proposed we begin an annual pilgrimage commemorating this effort. Jane had serious misgivings about her ability to walk that far. She began with one-hour walks and gradually built the strength and stamina to complete several of these walks. And since then, Clive and Jane have done Cradle Mountains walk as well as some serious trekking in New Zealand and elsewhere. In the years that followed our first pilgrimage, we facilitated people doing part of the walk. It occurs to me that we might revive this activity, as we have more young people in our church now than we did at the time that we did these walks. It's a great activity that can include people of different ages and fitness levels. Our pilgrimages were always held on a Saturday and ended up at Norwood, not Wakefield Street. I remember Barbara Willow dispensing warm foot baths and a team of people ladling lovely hot soup into mugs. On a walk that long, there is ample time for leisurely get-to-know-each-other conversations, as well as long periods of reflection time, walking meditation, if you will. Either way, as Jacqueline Stewart would have remarked, the old song, "You'll Never Walk Alone," applies. The idea of a divine spirit walking with you, or another person. The song works both ways. Clearly, walking worked for William Wordsworth, the prolific romantic poet who's written many fine poems in celebration of the natural world and spiritual connections. He clocked up 180,000 miles of walking in the Lake District and many other regions of Britain and the continent. But it is with my favourite poet that I'll finish up today, Rainer Maria Rilke. The poem is entitled Der Spaziergang. A walk. That's a walk for the sake of walking, not walking to the shops. I'll read you Robert Bly's translation. My eyes already touch the sunny hill, going far beyond the road I have begun. So we are grasped by what we cannot grasp. It has an inner light, even from a distance, and changes us, even if we do not reach it, into something else, which, hardly sensing it, we already are. A gesture waves us on, answering our own wave. But what we feel is the wind in our faces. Rilke tells us of the goal of a sunny hill. We've only just started on the walk. We have fixated onto the end of the path, but we cannot grasp its impact on us, even though the hill is far away. The end of the path changes us, even if we do not reach the goal. We sense the walker and the goal are already together. The goal and ourselves echo each other. The sign is blowing in the wind. The wind coming off the hill blows upon us this realization. I love the way Rilke uses a walk as a metaphor for life. We may have a goal, or fixate on a goal, or merely glimpse a goal, but we don't know where the path toward us will take us, or whether we'll ever reach us. The journey transforms us. In our lives, we need to accommodate, transform ourselves, make space for things to happen, and what better way than walking? We need to find a space for this time, away from busyness, chores, and obligations, no matter what our station or indeed our time of life. Now, I'm going to indulge myself, because the translation was a bit clunky, in reading Der Spaziergang auf Deutsch. I hope those of you with no German can just appreciate the rhythm and cadence of this nice, short, but insightful poem. Schon ist mein Blick am Hügel dem Besonnten, dem Wege, den ich kaum begann, voran. So fasst uns das, was wir nicht fassen konnten, volle Erscheinung aus der Ferne an. Und wandelt uns, auch wenn wir's nicht erreichen, in jenes, das wir kaum es ahnend sind, ein Zeichen weht, erwidend unserem Zeichen. Wir aber spüren nur den Gegenwind. Rainer Maria Rilke. And that concludes my talk entitled Stepping Out. I'm Jenny Deister, and I'm a member of the Unitarian Church of South Australia. We are likely to resume services in August at 99 Osmond Terrace, Norwood.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitariansa@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.